Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to The Art Detective with me, Dr. Yanina Ramirez. I'm an Oxford art historian, a broadcaster and a writer, but I'm also your chief investigator of images. Today, double pleasure for me. Not only are we talking about one of my favourite objects, artworks ever, but I'm with one of my favourite human beings in the world ever, Frank Cottrell Boyce. So you are amazing in so many ways.
So true.
Yeah, you are. You are. I mean, listeners, you'll know him as an award-winning children's writer. Wrote the incredible book Millions and also film screenwriter. So your latest film is about to hit the screens, isn't it? What's it called?
Goodbye, Christopher Robin.
And I have seen posters for it all over the buses of London. Yeah. This is real. This opened yesterday, didn't it?
Well, the premiere was last night. It opens on the 29th of September. So.
29th of September. Yeah. And it's about?
It's about A.A. Milne's relationship with his son, who really was called Christopher Robin, and who he inadvertently turned his son into this icon of childhood and made it very difficult for him to grow up.
Yeah.
So he became this kind of real-life Peter Pan.
Wow. So the whole film is exploring the boy and the father, I guess.
And success and how sometimes we get the wrong kind of success and we trap other people in our success. And it's about being a dad, really, in the end.
Which you are well experienced.
I am a dad. I am the daddy.
You are multiple daddy, aren't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
How many have you got?
I've got seven.
Seven. This is impressive stuff.
That's cool. Yeah.
But also, I think what I love about you, Frank, as well, though, you are completely committed to writing for children, aren't you? It means a lot to you.
Yeah, because I do remember reading books at a certain age and having my DNA changed by those books, particularly Ursula Le Guin, The Wizard of Earthsea.
Yes.
I remember reading The Wizard of Earthsea and thinking, oh, knowledge, knowing stuff is a power.
I can never be the same person again after
and
that. Yeah.
It's like there's a section in that when Ged has to sort of really get under the skin of knowing the names of things.
Yeah.
And it's just making swatting look magical.
Yeah.
And it turned me into a swat. I was off school sick and I'd never really been that big a student before, but that book made me into a school. I mean, everything about it I remember the font and the beautiful maps in the front and everything about it.
God, I
feel as though I've been to Earthsea. And it enchants the world then. So on our honeymoon, we went to the Western Isles.
Yeah.
And I'd never been outside Northwest England, really, except to go to university. North Wales, northwest of England.
Mm.
And I'd never seen anything like an archipelago in real life. And the minute I saw it, I thought, I'm in Earthsea.
Yeah.
I am in Earthsea. Yeah. I'm in the Happy Isles. I'm in, you know,
It is formative, isn't it? I mean, I think the books you read, I was thinking recently, because I got asked some questions about what books impacted you most. And I remember the night I read Wuthering Heights. I remember I stayed up all night. I was seven, which is so stupidly precocious.
Yeah, that's young.
But I cried and cried and cried when it was over because I wanted to go back and unread it so I could read it again and have the experiences again. But like you say, it's formative. It changes your life. I was never the same person.
And a beautiful, like what's beautiful, I think, is that if a children's book alerts you to the small pleasures, because it is in the end, it's the small pleasures that get you through the difficult times. And the Moomin books for me, the smell of coffee and pancakes. I'm in the Moomin house when I smell. So those things that are quite ordinary become magical because they take you to these other worlds. Wardrobes, come on.
I know.
Wardrobes.
Every
wardrobe you've ever looked at feels a little bit mysterious.
I still stay in old buildings and I'm like, I wonder, I'll just look.
Yeah, just check.
Just in case.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think, I mean, it's magic. And actually, the artwork we're talking about today, for me, is magical. I remember hearing about it for the first time when I was a first year undergraduate. And again, I think my life was changed by learning about this object. And it's the way it collapses literature and visuals in a way that I think so few things do.
It's just at the crossing point of so many, so many ancient monuments are silent. Oh, and we have to kind of think what they might have meant to say. And this is speaking to you so clearly, and it knows what it wants to say, and it knows what, and it's so eloquent, and it speaks to you. It literally speaks to you because it's a cross, and it has inscribed on it the Dream of the Rood, which is the first poem in English, or what we think of as English. But that is a poem in which the cross speaks. And here's a cross, and it's speaking this poem to you. I mean, it's amazing. It's a kind of multimedia thing. It is like something out of Kubrick or Doctor Who or something like that.
It feels
alive when you see it.
It does.
It feels like it's buzzing with energy.
We should tell the listeners what we're talking about.
Oh, God, sorry.
We're talking about the Ruthal Cross. Now, this is an early 8th century cross. It was destroyed during the Reformation, and the slabs were buried really in the graveyard outside this tiny little church.
Tiny church.
Just on the border of Scotland. And then it was reconstructed by a sympathetic vicar in the 19th century. And it is the most extraordinary early medieval object anywhere, in my opinion. I think it's possibly one of the reasons I became a medievalist, the Ruthal Cross.
I mean, what's immediately glamorous about it is that the poem is in runes. It's in runic letters, so it's sort of got a face towards the Viking world, and it's the poem, the Dream of the Rood, is by Cadman, which has got this sort of, so it's got this amazing provenance, the poem itself, that he dreamed it, and Hilda of Whitby is in the mix there because she's the one who said to him, because he was illiterate and she had it written down, and then it's written down on this amazing cross, you know, so it's so rich, and it's coming from so many directions at you.
And you've been to visit it, haven't you?
I've been to visit it maybe 30 or 40 times.
Have you been that many times? See, I haven't even got a patch on you. I've been about 10.
And that's impressive, Frank. Well, first of all, I have to say, we spent a lot of time in Dumfries and Galloway, and that tiny church with that across it, that is Dumfries and Galloway's premier indoor attraction. That and Morrison's. That's it. You know, if it's raining, that's where you're going. But it does repay a lot of visits because it's so dense and it's so detailed, and it's got these panels on it that tell not the whole life of Christ, but these key moments from the life of Christ in a particular way. So there's the washing of the, and what, do you know one thing I love about it? That the quality of workmanship is so various. So there's like, Mary Magdalene washing Jesus' feet or anointing his feet, and the figure of Jesus is just gorgeous. It's so brilliantly carved. And the figure of Mary Magdalene is completely carved. She's got this massive hand.
Yeah.
She's like some kind of like Smurf or something like that. And he's like this Viking lord with flowing locks and everything. So like, obviously two people are very off day.
The reason that these sorts of crosses are so fascinating to look at is because we're only looking at the skeleton.
Yes.
Because what would have been on top would have been, you know, plaster, and then a whole host of colour and gold and jewels.
Oh, see, I didn't know this.
Yeah, this is a joint learning experience, yeah.
Right.
But yeah, so while he is deeply carved and he's got his triple cruciform halo, she's quite superficially carved, but she probably would have been painted up really beautifully. And the big hand is it's a thing I'm passionate about in Anglo-Saxon art. They use big enlarged hands to signal. So they make hands look bigger because they're pointing or gesturing or indicating. It's like sign language.
Or like a note in the margin.
Exactly. So her big hand is showing that she's wiping his feet with her hair.
That's amazing.
So they've made it particularly large to emphasise that act of
So it's
service.
Really, that's what I mean, it's speaking to you, isn't
totally.
It? It's completely passionate about making a contact with you. It's not self-regarding. It's not saying, look at me. It's saying, listen to this.
It is.
All the time.
And so, I mean, this is the fascinating thing from your point of view, I guess, as a writer. And I studied English literature, which is how I came to the Ruthal Cross. I would never have gone into art history. I was going to be, you know, doing literature all the way through. But it was this idea that it's got
that wonderful rhetorical device, prosopopoeia, yes, which is the inanimate object
that
speaking,
yeah,
which is such an old English trope, isn't it? I mean, yeah, they use it all the time,
yes,
don't they?
Well, I mean, and it's the riddle book, isn't it?
Exactly.
In a riddle book, we call it riddles, but in a riddle book, it's an onion talking or a key talking. I picked out the rude ones.
You did, didn't you? You escaped the onion, which is the sexy one. Yeah. That's when all the undergraduates are going, ooh, an onion.
Yeah.
But yeah, they are. The riddles are all speaking. And yeah, they're like, I'm a book. I am a, yeah, you know, I am an onion.
Yeah, I'm an onion.
Say what I am.
Yeah.
But it's that mindset that I love about the Anglo-Saxons. They can sort of balance out the real and the fantastical and the imagined simultaneously.
Yeah.
One doesn't exclude the other.
Yes, 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 yes. And this is an inanimate object, but it is speaking to you.
Exactly.
And it's and the cross is speaking. And that's the Dream of the Rood takes that idea of something, an inanimate object speaking to a completely different level. I mean, it's so such an amazing poem.
Do you describe for the listeners what happens in the Dream of the Rood? It is the most extraordinary.
The Dream of the Rood is the cross, Jesus' cross, speaking as he's taken up to the crucifixion. So he's sharing the suffering and he's saying, I'm bedabbled with blood and I must be brave and I'm a warrior and I've got to fight, you know, for heaven and all this stuff. And it's like, it's epic and it's incredibly emotional, but it's a piece of wood talking. Yeah. I mean, it's such a, and there's a big thing in Christian tradition of trying to imagine yourself into nativity stories or into passion stories and be an onlooker. And that's like still a big part of Jesuit spirituality. But that's the ultimate one, that it's a piece of wood.
It's the most extraordinary poem because actually, in a funny sort of way, it gets around this really knotty theological problem of Christ as victor over,
yes,
the devil, over sin, and Christ as suffering,
yeah,
and weak.
Yeah.
And what the Dream of the Rood poem does, which no one else has thought to do, is to separate out those two identities, keep Christ as the triumphant warrior who leaps on the cross, doesn't he?
Yes, he runs to it
and leaps up. And he's celebrated like Beowulf at the end.
Yes,
they pull him,
yes,
down, they stand around his head like, yeah, a, you know, like a warrior. And then the pain, the dolorism, the grief of the crucifixion
is left on the wood.
The cross takes the pain.
Brilliant.
And the cross says, I am pierced with wounds. I am in sorrow. He is triumphant.
Yes.
So clever.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
And yet, you know, on top of all of that, it's just a blooming good bit of poetry,
isn't
it?
Oh, it's just an amazing read. It is just a wonderful. And what I love as well is that it kind of connects everything to nature. So you have that, the cross itself is covered in kind of vines and curlicues, and the animals on it are so great. Like in a medieval illuminated manuscript, it has these like squirrely lizardy things all over it, and in the there's in one of the scenes, it's the casting out of the Gadarene swine,
yeah,
and Jesus is shown standing on the pigs, and it's this like really strange epic, and the pigs are brilliant in this picture.
They look up and they cross their little hooves over,
yeah,
don't they?
Yeah.
And it's so I mean, the way that nature is brought in, I think, is really important, and also the way that women are brought in,
yes,
because there's a lot of women on the cross. And I mean, tell again, say for the people listening, it's big, isn't it? What sort of scale is it?
It's when you see it in the church, it's very intimidating, but it's actually standing in a well.
Mm-hmm.
So it must be like 12 feet tall.
I think it is.
Like
I think
that.
It's about 12 feet tall, and it's been reconstructed. And whoever reconstructed it put in the cross arm.
Yeah.
Because that's the bit that's been lost.
Yeah.
And they've put in weird symbols like a triangle and a whale
and a dragon.
Which aren't Anglo-Saxon.
Yeah, yeah.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Okay, so we were talking about where the cross is. Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, because you said earlier that it was put together again by a sympathetic clergyman, but he's so much more than that. Henry Duncan, who was the vicar, is it vicar? Minister, anyway, of Ruthill in the 1820s, was one of those British clergymen who were real polymaths and really cared about their parishioners and really brought learning and excitement to the parishes that they lived in. People like Gilbert White, but he's really special. So, for instance, there's an eccentric side to him, or he was a really good paleontologist. Mm. He discovered, he didn't unearth himself, I think he was responsible for kind of salvaging the first quadruped fossil footprints that were found in Britain.
No.
Which were found in the Corncockle Quarry, which is not far away. And he brought them to the vicarage and he asked, to the manse, sorry, and he asked Frank Buckland, who was this very eccentric Oxford zoologist, to come up and explain them to the workmen from the quarry who had found it, which is just, isn't that amazing that he did that? And this fantastic scene then in the manse where Buckland covered the table in dough and made a mock-up of the fossil footprints and then articulated them so that they could see how big the legs must have been to make this stride.
Gosh.
And kind of inspire them with the idea of, well, I can't even remember what it was, like an iguanodon or something like that, but so that they would see the scale of what this creature had been. It's amazing.
And this is all going on in and around Ruthill.
It's 20 cottages. You've got clackens, little white clackens. There's 20, maybe a few more than that. It's very, very, it's not, when you say it's a village, it's not like an English village with a tithe barn and all that stuff.
It's got nothing really there apart
from the church.
The
church is off to one side of it as well. It's not that close. And he saw there was a great poverty there, obviously, and he started the very first savings bank.
No.
He taught them
the same guy, the vicar.
The same guy, the very, very first savings bank in the world, which became the trustee savings bank. And they all put in and he invested in Dumfries and they all got a little return. And you can go to Ruthill, there's a little tiny, tiny museum where you can see the little tin that the money was put in. And
that's amazing.
He started a newspaper and he restored the Ruthill Cross. And he even then, in the 1820s, it was still too controversial to put it in the church. Obviously, to put it in the church, even logistically, was difficult. But even in the church grounds. So it wasn't put up in the churchyard. It was put up in the manse garden.
Gosh.
So that the Church of Scotland elders couldn't say anything about it. It was just on private property. He said something like, it's of no more significance than a sundial.
Woo-hoo-hoo!
Because he wanted it there, you know, and he could see that it was an extraordinary object. And
he was an antiquarian in that respect.
He was everything. He was an antiquarian, he was an economist, he was a journalist, he was a priest, you know.
Amazing. And what he did by sort of getting these things out of the ground is brilliant for me as an art historian because, you know, the idea that they were three quarters submerged in soil means they're so well protected.
Yes.
And it means that, I used to go on these amazing trails when I was in York on the search of Anglo-Saxon sculpture. And these things, these crosses, these stone sculptures, they were all over the landscape in the north of England. But it's an amazing treasure trail. So I used to get my corpus of Anglo-Saxon stone sculpture and hunt out these blocks that are just in people's rockeries.
Oh, okay.
They're just dotted around churchyards.
Right.
And these are Anglo-Saxon stones that have been pulled down or destroyed or
removed. And repurposed.
And repurposed. But he obviously knew what this was supposed to be. And it's actually the only complete intact one.
Yeah. Oddly, it's because it was controversial that it's been saved.
Right.
If it hadn't had that kind of aura of popery and Satanism around it, they wouldn't have buried it, would they? They'd just put it into a sheepfold or something.
Yeah,
like
absolutely.
That.
Reused a big useful lump of stone. And I mean, I think they're quite odd objects anyway, these crosses, because they're poised on this moment of such great ideological change. Yeah. I mean, this is, we're probably saying, what, 720-ish?
Yeah.
Early 8th century.
Yeah.
But we think about Roman Christianity coming about 597 uh-huh. with Augustine into Thanet. And yet that's a long and slow process. It starts off with converting the top echelons of society.
And isn't it rubbing up against Celtic Christianity here as
totally,
well?
Totally, totally. We are in this hotbed in the north of England where over from Ireland via Iona over to Lindisfarne, you've got the Celtic Christianity. Yeah. And then sweeping up from the south, you've got Roman Christianity.
Two different dates for Easter and
two different dates for Easter, two different hairstyles.
Two different hairstyles.
They dress differently.
Two different views of women.
Definitely. You know, and nature.
And of nature.
The relationship with nature. Yeah. That is absolutely and central, I think, to what we're looking at here, because this is a cross that's talking.
Yeah.
It's a piece of wood that's talking.
It's a piece of wood that's talking. And immediately you're saying that, I'm thinking about Columbkill and Columba and how it's all, you know, the dove. I am the dove, you know, I live on a rock. Derry of the ash grove. He said that every leaf of every oak tree in Derry has a little angel.
Oh,
you know that, you know.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And even Cuthbert, you know, being brought treats by the otters. And
yeah. Well, yeah, I love that about those guys. They just walked and walked and walked. And if there was no one listening, they'd just talk to seals.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's fine.
Hang out with the birds. Yeah. Yeah. But there's so many kind of fundamental reasons for why the two types of Christianity are different. But primarily because Romans never got to Ireland. Ireland evolved differently. It didn't have its cities.
Yeah, that's what it comes down to, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it kind of maintains this tribal.
Well, and Ruffle is only a little drive from Ninian's Cave, which is, you know, so long before Augustine, you had Ninian landed in it, like 320.
Oh,
absolutely. Crazy day, you know.
Yeah.
And when you go, and every year there's a mass in that cave at the end of the summer.
I know, because you were torn, weren't you?
Oh, yeah, that's right. You've got to Ruffle. They're on the same day. What are you talking about? You know,
just to confuse you.
Yeah,
you can either see the Rother Cross.
But I always go to that mass, and it's like it's very that Anglo-Saxon idea of voyage and wanderer is so strong there because it's a big shingle beach with a little tiny, and you can see the Isle of Man and you can see Ireland and this perilous sea. Mm. You know, again, it's in Columba, isn't it? That like, I'll just go.
Yeah.
We'll get in a boat, we'll go, and when we can't see Ireland, we'll stop. You know?
Yeah, and you know, if we wash up on a pagan shore and all get massacred, that's then the at least we tried. Yeah.
If we come across the Loch Ness Monster, we'll deal with it.
Yeah. You know? They're amazing. They're so, and it is, I mean, people often laugh about things like Cinder Whitby and that the Romans and Celtic Church, they can't mean that different, can they? But actually, they were really quite different.
Well, and physically, I mean, like, you know, you're talking about this big change and how Anglo-Saxon culture, you know, or Christianity appropriates things from Anglo-Saxon. You know, there's an exchange of ideas. I mean, it's such a short voyage from Ireland, and where Ruthwell is a very, very short distance from Whittorn, mm-hmm. which is where Ninian landed in, I think, 320, like crazy, crazy early. So that idea of those guys who set out from Derry, this Scott after the Battle of the Books, you know.
Fighting over a book.
Fighting over a book, fighting over copyright.
Yes. Earliest ever example of copyright infringement.
To every book it's copy. To every cow it's calf, to every book it's copy.
Exactly.
And so Columba lost that, and there was the Battle of the Books, and as an act of repentance he went out. That image of like life on earth being perilous and ungovernable, which, like a sea voyage, is such a powerful image in, and it's so in early Christianity, but it's so obviously informed by Viking lifestyle and about, you know, if you want to get anywhere, you have to get in a boat, just get in a boat, get in a boat, get in a boat. And that's what they're doing. And that's like the whole image of that central image of Celtic Christianity is so powerful to me, that the idea that you're just in a boat and you have to trust the wind, and wherever it lands you, that is where you're supposed to be.
Supposed to be there.
And just get on with it.
Yeah, and it's often.
And if it's a rock, talk to the seals.
Totally. Yeah, there's always something to keep company.
But if it's in Northumberland, well, just go and convert the king.
Yeah.
You know? That's the way it is.
I love it when the Irish monks start arriving along the pagan coasts of Germany, Saxony, and they keep going out in groups of 12.
Yeah.
12 of them in a curragh, this sort of canoe thing.
Yeah.
And they just keep rocking up on the beaches and getting slaughtered because they keep turning up going, hey, have you guys heard about God? The Saxons like,
no, you're dead.
So, but they kept going.
Yeah.
And they didn't give up. But I think voyaging is amazing. And also this idea of a journey in Old English poetry.
The Wanderer is the big Old English poem.
So I guess you've enjoyed reading The Wanderer.
Yeah, I love The Wanderer, I love The Wanderer for exactly that reason, about, you know, that you just keep going and you trust that the journey is meaningful in itself, wherever it's going to land you.
Yeah.
And I love the way it sucks all those... See, is it right to say it's appropriate? Because it's like, no, it's like they've managed to sort of take the light of Christianity and shine it on their lives as it's lived.
Right.
And find meaning in it from them. So the mead hall becomes okay. And there's that wonderful image of the sparrow coming in from the storm and flying through the mead hall and out again. I mean, these are very... The parables themselves from the Gospels are about farming in the Middle East. And so they took that idea that it's about your ordinary life.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's about, you know, Christianity is about akura. It's about being killed by people who just ship up on your shore and chop you up. What are you going to do about it? You know, and it's about life, you know, and it's so full of the texture of ordinary life.
I think that's what's so fascinating about the Rattle Cross and the Dream of the Rood, the poem that's inscribed on the sides of it. It is adaptation. It's not that they're blindly just saying, yeah, we'll absorb everything that's coming into us from Rome, from Christianity. They're saying, well, actually, we've got a culture and a literature and an identity that goes back hundreds of years that we're really proud of.
Yeah.
So let's see how we can fit that in with these new Christian ideas.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think the Dream of the Rood is one of the most extraordinary heroic poems.
Yeah.
Because, you know, instead of showing Christianity is a bit of a dodgy religion for the Anglo-Saxons, the Scandinavians, because their main god is quite weak and he dies voluntarily.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
And so that's not what gods do in their world.
No, it's what's completely astonishing.
Yeah.
You get a god who dies
voluntarily.
Yeah.
And so they kind of
hero death as well.
Not even a nice, a criminal's death.
Yeah.
But then they take this poem and they say, no, we're going to turn him into a hero, don't they?
Yeah, yeah.
I want you to read some.
Okay.
Go on.
I mean, I love it that it's the word, you know, because I was just thinking as you were talking about Cahullan tying himself to a pillar and fighting to the last. And that's how the cross is in this. This is what the hero is tied to.
Yeah, absolutely.
As he fights the last.
And he sort of jumps up willingly, doesn't he? Go on, you've got to read.
So this is the cross speaking about Christ. Us both they basely mocked and handled. Was I there with blood bedabbled, gushing grievous from his dear side, when his ghost he had uprendered. Christ was on rood tree, but fast from afar, his friends hurried to aid their athling. Everything I saw. Sorely was I with sorrows harrowed, yet humbly I inclined to the hands of his servants, striving with might to aid him. With streels was I wounded. Down they laid him, limb weary, o'er his lifeless head. Then stood they, heavily gazing at heaven's chieftain.
Oh,
so rich.
I mean, already in there we've got athling, chieftain. When I do it in Old English with my students, I make them look at the exact words that are carved, because they're not biblical words. They translate as Lord, Prince of Heaven, but actually they're legal terms. They're actually the sorts of words you would use for the Lord of the Manor, the Knight of the Realm.
Yes. Yeah.
And they've just mashed it up and come up with something so completely original.
But they've got to an emotional truth of it, because they're the words that command, you know, that speak of loyalty and love and gratitude and protection.
Yeah.
You know, they're not aggrandizing. They're trying to find what the emotional connection is.
I think it's odd, isn't it? Because the whole idea of... I've just been making a program about the Reformation and Tyndale's Bible.
Right.
And the idea of translating the Bible into English is so controversial. To put the sacred text into the vernacular...
Yeah.
It takes hundreds and hundreds of years for that to happen. But what you've got with the Dream of the Rood, like in the 8th century, is an attempt in the English tongue, in runes, to tell the story of the Passion, the story of the Gospels, in a way that no one's ever told it before.
Exactly.
And it's completely new, isn't it?
Yes, it is completely new, but it's also very like the Gospels.
Yeah.
You know, because that guy telling those stories obviously knew about farming. And the guy who wrote the Dream of the Rood bloody knew about wood.
But, you know, it is that thing as well. I love the idea that it's never one answer. So the rood tree, which it says in there, this is the idea, isn't it, of this. There's an old tradition in Christian art of the skull of Adam being underneath the hill of Calvary.
Yes.
And then the cross, the wood used for the cross, being the tree that grew out of that skull. And the idea of a living rood, a living tree, becomes quite powerful in Christian art. But there they've kind of said it's still a living tree because it's got a voice.
Yeah.
And the tree imagery.
The tree.
It comes up the sides, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because what have we got on the sides of the cross?
All those vines and branches and leaves. Yeah.
And all the animals the embedded animals, in the it.
Lizardy things.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And so it's like a living tree as well.
Yeah,
isn't
and
it?
It's the world tree, isn't it? It's Yggdrasil as well.
You know? Yeah, it is. They're bringing it all together.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, I really hope that the listeners have got a sense of how much we love this object because.
You'll never know how much I love this object. I think it's the best physical object in Britain.
I have to agree with you. To me, it's a life changer. It's a complete, for somebody, like, well, for both of us, we love language, we love words, we love literature,
yeah.
And we love these sorts of visual guides to what we're thinking about.
Yeah.
It's a cross that talks.
Yeah.
I mean, that's awesome.
We're talking after the morning after, that's why I'm a bit groggy, the premiere of my film, and in film you use light and you use words and you use darkness to tell a story, and when you go to that cross it's words, it's images, and it's light, because it does change throughout the day, you know.
And if we think about it, how it would have been seen at the time. I mean, also one of the things we're not quite sure about with these crosses, but yeah, they were plastered, yeah, they were painted, but there's even suggestions that they might have had candles attached on the outside.
Oh, right, okay.
Jewels in the eyes.
Oh wow.
So again, imagine that sort of cinematic thing, the flickering flames.
And when you, I mean, if you're around that, I mean, I love that area, but it's very one color.
Yeah.
And to come across something that's sort of flickering and gold in that context.
Yeah.
It's big, wide mud flats and green fields and not much else, you know. So it must have been really kind of punched through.
Yeah. Well, that's why I like to think of them a little bit like advertising billboards, because they're bright. They're breaking up the monotony, but they're also, you know, they're saying something that matters at the time. This is the big new thing. Christianity is here.
Yeah.
And, you know, these are the big messages you can get
saved. But also, they create spaces, don't they? You know, I live... I mean, one of the things we could have talked about is I live on the beach of Crosby, where those Anthony Gormley statues are, which was an empty space, and now it's got 100 statues, and that seems to kind of redefine the space. If you go to Rothwell, Solway Firth, it's flat, it's muddy, and then suddenly there's this big object in the middle of it. It's a man-made landmark.
Yeah.
And it completely... That would have defined that area very, very clearly, I think.
But even the material it's made out of, stone as well. This idea that everybody is living in timber. Everybody is building in wattle and daub.
And the ground is in flux. You know, it's mud. It's completely changing. It's a very, very unstable environment. It's wetlands. It's called Merse.
Yeah.
And this is a very solid, unchanging object.
And the idea that it's defying time. It's just standing there. And it's still there now.
Yes, it is. Yes.
It's this thing that has defied time because and the message is still defying time. So, I mean, I just think it's the most extraordinary thing. Art Detective listeners, I hope you will, if you can, get to Rothwell and see it. Because it's just too much to almost describe, isn't
it? Yeah, it is. And you have to go knock on the door and borrow the key and get in.
You do. Yeah. You do. It's lovely. It's a little adventure. Yeah. But if you can't get to it, there are casts of it in the V&A. It's not the same as seeing it, but you get a sense of the scale.
Yeah.
What a pleasure to talk to you. I can't imagine anyone in the world I'd rather spend time with talking about one of my favourite things in the world.
Thank you very much.
And if you want to follow me on Twitter or subscribe to the podcast, do so. You can subscribe by going to historyhit.com/artdetective. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm Dr. Yanina Ramirez. You're on Twitter too, aren't you, Frank?
I am, Frank. I'm on Twitter as Frank Cottrell. You'll find me.
I'll link through. But yeah, you're great on Twitter. Good to follow. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Loads of exciting art detectives coming up. Do subscribe, stay tuned, and thank you, Frank, for a wonderful time.
Thank you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.